Hey everybody, how are you? Welcome back. Welcome back to another week of the show. Very excited about this episode. I'm wondering if I can just take a few moments of your time here at the top of the episode. Will you grant me that, please? If you'll grant me just a few moments to just talk to you about some things. You normally talk about this at the end of the episode, and I thought this week I'd put it at the top of the episode. Please don't fast forward. Just give me, it'll be a couple minutes, and then we're going to get into this lovely episode. I want to take just a couple minutes at the top here to talk about patreon.com/AustinArcher. There are, right now, about 125 of you fine folks out there who are monthly subscribers to patreon.com/AustinArcher, and you just mean the world to me. And I really mean that from the bottom of my heart. I really mean that sincerely. This is, for those of you who don't know, this is my full-time job. A lot of times on live streams or in the comments, people will ask me, what do you do? What's your real job? And I tell them, this is my job. Not just this podcast. The podcast is part of my job, but the content that I make online for Instagram and YouTube and TikTok, the songs that I put out, the content that I make for brands, things like that. This is what I do. I don't have a main source of income outside of this. And a lot of the work that I do is freelance work. I'm getting contracts to, you know, produce content for brands, to produce, you know, make songs for, I write songs for other people's podcasts, their podcast theme, a song for a YouTube show, you know, whatever, a jingle for a product that they sell. This, that, and the other thing. But the thing about freelance work is it's sort of, you know, it comes when it comes, and it's not there when it's not there. And there's not a whole lot of consistency or reliability. And the amazing thing about a thing like Patreon is it allows someone like me, a full-time creative, a full-time creator, to have a source of reliable, consistent monthly income. And the where it's at right now is nothing that I could actually make a living on. That's not to say that it's not helpful. It absolutely is. And the people who are there, I just thank you from the bottom of my heart. But it's just to say that, you know, we have gained a lot of listeners on this podcast in the last few months, which is fantastic. I'm very excited about it. And I just wanted to make those of you who might not be aware that that is a way that if you have the means, if you have the available extra expendable income on a monthly basis to throw $4 or $5 or $7 or even $10 a month at my Patreon at patreon.com/AustinArcher. It'd be amazing. It would be amazing, and you would be helping to fund this operation. I mean, I'm pretty much a one-man show, but I do hire people for different tasks. I have a lot of expenses that come with doing this full-time, and that come with, I mean, all the gear that I have to buy for my studio constantly. And right now I have a video editor that's editing the video version of this podcast into smaller clips for YouTube and even smaller vertical clips for TikTok and Instagram and all that stuff. And there's audio engineers that I work with that I pay for music and things like that. And there's a lot of expenses that come with. Essentially, I'm like I said, a one man operation, I'm an LLC now, and there's even expenses that come with that. And a thing like patreon.com/AustinArcher goes a long way in helping to make sure that this show can keep moving forward. So if this is something that you get value from, if this is something that has ever helped you through something or to understand something better or helped you feel seen or heard or understood in some way, or if this is just something that you like coming back to week after week, if you just find this show to be a comforting part of your routine and you would like to support us on a monthly basis, I say us, but really it's me, on a monthly basis, I'd love to have you over there. I'll be full disclosure, I'm not great at keeping up with the Patreon perks, and my Patreon patrons know that. I think the number one perk to supporting my Patreon is knowing that you are helping to keep this thing alive, to keep the podcast alive, to keep the content that I make on Instagram and TikTok and YouTube alive, and to keep this train chugging forward. But there is occasional TikTok exclusive content. If you subscribe, you'll see there are TikTok exclusive podcasts and TikTok exclusive videos and occasional perks that pop up from being a Patreon patron. But I just wanted to say at the top of the show here, a big thank you to those of you who are subscribed, and just an invitation to anyone who might have the means to consider joining this year and maybe doing it for a year or maybe even 6 months, or just, you know, whatever you can afford. And if you can't afford it, if it's just not something that's in your budget, that's totally okay. And there are many ways that you can support this show and what I do for free. You can share the episodes of the podcast that you like. You can share my videos. A really simple way to support my operation is to follow me on Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. So if you only follow on TikTok, for instance, it would go a long way if you followed on all three of those main platforms, TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. Just that simple thing, totally free, goes a long way. Another simple way that you can support this show that is kind of like a one-time donation and you get something for it is now that's what I call a bunch of Austin Archer's TikTok songs compiled into an album. Volume 4 is now available on Bandcamp. So this is volume 4 of my TikTok songs. I've been doing these for a few years now. Every like 6 months I put one out, and it's just a compilation of like the little songs that I do on TikTok, and I put together like 15 to 17 of them in an album. And it's always a fun time. It's an easy listen because every song is like a minute long. And there's a lot of variety in the way that the songs sound. Some of the songs are just really silly and fun. Some of the songs are actually quite introspective and thought-provoking. And some of the songs, because I can't help myself, have a good dose of sincerity and, you know, earnestness and heart. And I'm proud of this anthology, all four of them, volume 1, 2, 3, and 4, and volume 4 is now available. And it's if you're listening to this on Friday, February 3rd, which is when the podcast comes out, it's available today. It went on sale today, and today, Friday, February 3rd, is Bandcamp Friday. It's the day where Bandcamp waives their service fee and gives 100% of sales to the artist. So if you buy that album today, or if you buy all four of the albums today, or any of my albums on Bandcamp, because all of my music is available on Bandcamp, 100% of what you buy today will go to me, and it will go to supporting this show and supporting the music that I make and supporting the content that I make. And if that's a more feasible way for you to support, just with like a one-time donation, I think that's a great option, because you're going to get something back too. You're going to get all that music and all of that stuff that I've poured many hours and lots of blood, sweat, and tears, and lots of my heart and my soul into. So if you want to check that out, I hope you do. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you share it with your friends and say, hey, check this out, and spread it around. But if all you're doing is just being here week after week and listening and that's your way of participating, I still am just thrilled to have you. I'm really thrilled to have you here. I just wanted to extend that invite to anyone who has the means or the ability and would like to be a part of helping to produce this show and helping to keep this show alive and keep my content alive and keep this operation alive. Thank you to those of you who have already been helping. You are just invaluable to this operation. And yeah, that's my spiel. Thank you so much for not fast-forwarding. You didn't, right? You didn't fast forward. You listened to it. Yep. Yes, you did. Because you're the best. Thank you so much. Love you so much. I'm so excited about this episode. You are so lucky. You're in for such a treat. Last week, you got to listen to Niall Breslin's beautiful Irish accent. You get two amazing Irish people in a row. Louise Carroll is here, who is a musician and a psychologist and just a wearer of many hats and a very intelligent fascinating individual, who also just happens to be the partner of Niall Breslin, who was on the podcast last week. So it's a really nice little 1-2 punch for you on back-to-back weeks. I'm thrilled that I got her in here. I'm excited for you to listen to it. So here we go. Without further ado, from a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking with my friend Louise Carroll about emotional reality. What's up, YouTube? What's up, everybody out there listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you are? How's it going? What's the crack? Louise, what's the crack?
What is the crack, Austin? Not how is your crack? What is the crack?
What is what does that mean? Because Niall said that too last week, and I love it so much. But I'm like, I don't want to misuse it, and it's such great slang. Because you also say like it's great crack. Like you can come over
great crack.
Yeah, we're gonna have great crack. Yeah. Over here.
Yeah, and it's the same, but it's spelled C-R-A-I-C. All right, it's not
crake.
Well, it's Irish.
Yeah, C-R-A-I-C, and it's pronounced crack.
Crack. So uh-huh. What's the crack is what's going down, what's going up, what are you getting involved in? Is there a party going on? Is there something that I need to know about? Fill me in immediately. It encompasses all of those things.
What's up,
what's
down?
The crack?
What's the crack?
Yeah, what's the crack?
When I was a kid, we used to write in notes to each other in school, like, W-A-Z was, so we'd say was, and then we'd have an arrow pointing up and an arrow pointing down, and then we would do the at symbol, and that meant was up, down, all around. And I think that that's what's the crack means.
I like that. Yeah, I like that. It's a 360 degree of trying to enter into your world. Fill me in. What's the crack?
Yeah, if I was at a party in America and I told my friends, you got to get over here, we've got really great crack.
Oh, yeah.
It would mean something different. that would
mean something quite dramatically different.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, where are you? Like, yeah, I'm at a party with great crack. Come over.
Are you trapped there? Yeah.
No, actually, my life is different now that I've smoked this crack pipe. And I actually understand things about life that I didn't understand before. Yeah. You've got to get over here. We've got great crack.
Yeah. Okay. That's quite different. So it's always important to spell it, I think.
Yeah, right. Because it would be spelled C-R-A-C-K.
That's, yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. No. Never spelled that way. Never spelled that way. Always an I. And it is authentic Gaeilge. Irish. I was trying to think, is it, or did we make that up? Sometimes call it a bastardization of the English language, of the Irish language, when we just twist things. Like helicopter in Irish is helicopter.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it spelled the same?
As a fada on the E.
Oh, okay. So what you said, Gaeilge?
Gaeilge.
Gaeilge.
Gaeilge. So Irish in the Irish word is Gaeilge.
Gaeilge.
Good. That was okay. That was very good.
All right. And so I kept hearing this when I was in Ireland this summer, that people would say like, oh, well, it's in Irish. Or like when I went to go see Brezzy perform at that festival, I was like, oh, he's going to be singing in Irish. Mm. So Irish, it just means Gaelic or right?
Yeah. It's the vernacular. Like Gaeilge is, we're just saying it in English by saying Irish.
Mm.
You get me? That,
yeah.
Yeah.
Espanol versus Spanish.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. This is what you came to talk to me about.
I mean, this is the important stuff.
I just think my audience is going to be very excited that for the second week in a row they get to listen to. Like, it's so funny how easily entertained Americans are. They're like, ooh, like, it sounds different. So I can't tell you how many people last week listened to the podcast and were like, I just like listening to his voice.
He gets that a lot. I don't really get that. Sorry in advance. I have a much more sharper pitch than he does. He's got these dulcet honey tones, you know, that literally guide people to sleep in his meditations. So yeah, he makes a living off his voice.
Yeah, if people don't know, I mean, like my guest last week, Niall Breslin, that's your partner.
Yeah.
How did the two of you meet?
We're both in the music industry. Mm-hmm. And years ago I was making my own album. Mm-hmm. It was a solo album, and my producer sent it to Niall. I hadn't met Niall at this point, just for feedback and for, you know, if he wanted any input on the songwriting. And that was the first time we'd kind of, and we hadn't even met at that point. That was all via email at the time. That's how long ago it was.
His input was, tell her I want to take her to dinner.
No, it took a further 10 years, I think, for that to happen.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Shy guy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah. So then we met some years later. He had his own personal solo album launch. Personal album. That sounds very different. Solo album launch. And we met there. And then 2 years after that, he asked me to do some vocals on the album. So he's in a band called The Blizzards.
Mm-hmm.
And I did some vocals for a couple of tracks on their album. And then the following year, they needed a new bass player. And I pretended I could play the bass.
Amazing. Which I think if there's any instrument in a band that you can like lie and say you play and then figure it out, it's the bass.
That's exactly what I did. New Year's Day, can you play the bass? I said yes.
Mm-hmm.
I said, when is the first rehearsal? He said April. So I said, okay, January to April? I have this. I got this.
Yeah, if you lie and say you can play the fiddle, you're fucked. If you lie and say you can play the drums, you're most likely fucked.
Yeah.
Unless it's just like a kick and a snare, like boom chick, boom chick.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know,
and the cymbals between your knees.
Exactly, with the one-man band. Exactly.
Yeah.
Speaking of one-man bands and just doing a lot and wearing a lot of hats, and while we're like in the topic of like who you are and what you do, and we talked about this last week with Brezzy, like he does so many things, but you're the same way. Like you wear a lot of hats and you do a lot of things. Mm. What are like if someone were to be like, this is who Louise Carroll is, because I have the same problem when people try to give me a title to like what it is that I do. And I don't want to be a pretentious douche and be like, well, it's a lot of things. Like it's, but like, how would you describe yourself?
Do you know what I've found? It's funny you ask that question in a way, because I'm percolating around this particular thing at the moment, and this happens every couple of years for me where I hit a point and I think, what needs to take more weight in my life? What needs to dominate more? And when it doesn't, and the balance is off, and I do too much of one thing instead of the other, I start to feel really agitated. It's just a sort of a perpetual level of agitation. And I'm actually hovering around that space now. And I'm a psychologist, and I'm also a musician. I'm a composer. And that's probably bluntly how I'd say it. But, you know, those two things are very different, actually. You know, okay, one, psychology is in the inner world. It's about other people's inner world. Whereas art and creativity and composing and writing is very much my inner world. So if I find that I've spent an inordinate amount of time giving outward or putting outward or inviting the outside world in, then it's literally like I lose fuel. I drain. It's like of the life force drains for what I can put into the creative energy and the art and the composing and the thoughts. It's like I thrive off that inner experience, and if I don't have enough of it, my fuel gauge just goes to empty.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel the same way, where like I have to have a certain amount of creative engagement in my life. But also I've never been comfortable relegating myself to just one place or one job or one role or one title. Yeah. Is that sort of?
Yeah. Yeah, it is that, I think. But yet when I do the one thing, I want to go all in.
Sure.
Yeah. So I actually, it's akin to torture for me to only touch the surface on different things, which is why I hit the wall after a while and then need to move over to the other one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Real quick, let's get you just to nudge that thing in closer. It's a little off to the side. Okay. And I think we're losing some of you a little bit. Okay. Somebody in the comments was like, ooh, I'm having a hard time hearing. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. So
that's my squealy Irish voice.
I think if we just get it like more like directly at your mouth,
is that better?
Then we should be good.
Okay.
Because also I'm like, I'm turning up the gain and I'm getting like a weird feedback sound on it too, which is annoying. But I think we should be good.
Okay.
There.
Cool. Cool.
At least it sounds good in my ears, and I don't know.
Sure, we're having a good chat.
Yeah, like I can hear you, but this person online was like, I can't hear. So I'm like, well, all right, well, we'll try.
Okay.
Okay. So you wear a lot of hats. Many of them are creative, but also like psychology. Like you like to explore just what makes humans tick and what makes our brains go boop and all that stuff, as do I. Yeah. I mean, that's what this podcast is too. Is like, I'm like, yeah, sure. I like making music and I like making people laugh, but I also just like to sit down with people and be like, why are we like this? Why do I act like this? Mm-hmm. And what can we do about it? If anything,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I mean, like as a kid, I remember that. As a child, I remember being fascinated as to why, particularly why people were mean. I think I was a very sensitive, soft child, and I just couldn't understand why people would be deliberately mean. And I remember that from a very early age. And then I remember watching the news with my parents, actually, in the 90s. And there was there was a murder in Cork, which is in Skull, which is very west of Ireland, far away from a really sleepy town. Nothing happened there. And it was a huge deal in Ireland at the time. That wouldn't, you know, we never heard of this. But I remember that was the epitome of it. I remember thinking, okay, what drives somebody to take another's life? What has happened in their lives to get them to the point of doing that? And I want to know. I want to understand what that is. Now, consequently, the suspect of that ended up in my car 20 years later.
But no! What?
Yeah, that's a longer story.
Well,
yeah.
It ended up in your car, did you say? Mm-hmm. How?
So...
Oh my God, no. Sorry.
Yeah.
My phone went off. God. We're off to a terrible start here. I need to put my phone on Do Not Disturb.
That was like a cliffhanger.
Also, they changed the focus settings on the iPhone,
yeah.
And I don't know how to do it anymore. So it used to be really simple. It was just a toggle that you turn on Do Not Disturb. And now it's like this really weird thing where like when I open Do Not Disturb, it's like silence notifications from people, non-silence from apps. And I'm like, just have it be a toggle where I just turn it on.
Airplane?
Yeah, maybe airplane. That's the easy way, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm going
to
do.
I like to put it on an airplane and... Throw it like an airplane.
I'm throwing it over there.
Get out of my life.
Yep.
Phone.
That's what I just did. So, all right. Okay. I'm sorry. You were saying about this guy that wound up in your car. This is crazy.
Yes. And that's a long story. But for me, it was very symbolic because it was a coming together of two areas of my life, which was psychology and music. So this happened I got into psychology because I need to find out what drives people to do that. That was the real catalyst moment for me. And then 20 years later, I was also composing. So I was writing music for film and TV. And I was part of a documentary called Murder in the Cottage at the beginning with Jim Sheridan, who was following a man called Ian Bailey, who was the suspect of this murder, of the Sophie Toscan du Plantier murder in West Cork.
This is wild.
Right?
Yeah.
I know. So I was going to court. I was going to the hearings. This is 20 years later, by the way, because there was no trial at the time because they didn't have enough evidence. It's the craziest story. But the French courts did have a trial in absentia and convicted him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So he was convicted in France but couldn't be expedited because he was in Ireland. But they were having hearings in Ireland to try and get him expedited on behalf of France.
I think about this stuff all the time, too. I think that's what people's fascination is with true crime documentaries and stuff like that. I think it's like a hard thing to talk about out loud because it makes you sound like you're experiencing but also I think that that's like what intrusive thoughts are. Like I saw a TikTok video the other day where someone was talking about how they get bothered when people are like, oh, my intrusive thoughts one today, I cut my hair. And they were like, no, like intrusive thoughts when they're debilitating or when they're like people who with OCD and with different conditions can experience intrusive thoughts where it's not just like, ooh, what if I dyed my hair? What if I like bought this like really expensive thing online? It's more like you just see a person and it's like, what if I killed that person? And then you're like, whoa. And it's not that you actually are homicidal and want to kill someone. Mm-hmm. It's just that all of a sudden that thought arises without any prompting of your own, without any from seemingly nowhere where like you're not the person who like, and you're like, I'm not going to do that. But it creates tremendous anxiety in people because they're like, I don't, my brain just generated that. It just out of nowhere went like, what if, you know, or they said in the video too. And I thought like, I actually have had this thought before where like, they'll be in public and they'll like look at a child that will smile at them and they'll smile back and then their brain will be like, why'd you smile at that kid? Are you attracted to kids? And they're like, no, I just smile. But the brain's like, yeah, you are. You're attracted to that little kid. And it's like, I'm not attracted to the kid.
Yeah.
But it's like, why is that thought popping in there? And then it's very, you're like, you're scared of like, who am I? Do I know who I am?
Yeah.
And I think that it is important to study and to treat people who have acted out impulses that arise from or maybe originate from intrusive thoughts, it's important to treat them like human beings and to remember that, like, they have the same basic infrastructure that you have, yeah. and they have the same mechanisms that led to them being in that situation where they made that choice, that, you know, and then you got, you kind of like want to study it to go like, how did it go from an intrusive thought to a desire to an uncontrollable impulse to I'm doing it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, part of my fascination in my work as well is attachment, you know, which is where it all began. Mm-hmm. Right, where all of us, it's where it all began. How we function now, how we show up for ourselves, how we show up with other people, the relationships we have, the patterns we hit in the relationships that we have, maybe time and time and time again, even the relationships that we have in work, you know, how we relate to other people, even in conflict, even in happy situations, in frustrating, challenging situations, all of that is so determined by attachment, by what we believe to be true about another person, what we believe to be true about ourselves, but also what we believe to be true about another person's perception of us. And so we're often acting out with another person based on what we think is true.
Yes. So this is a very roundabout way to get to what I actually wanted to talk to you about today. Cause we actually probably could just go off and talk about intrusive thoughts and talk about, attachment styles, which I think are also great topics. But I wanted to talk about kind of like this idea of emotional reality and the idea of like how certain things in our experience. And I think that this is in what we were just saying that like, attachment style, it informs into attachment styles and things like this. Like, what is the emotional reality of how you're experiencing a relationship with another person? There's certain things, especially like relationships and love and situations of intimacy and becoming interdependent and things like that, that so much of the experience is ineffable and really unable to be intellectualized in a certain way. I'm gonna read this thing. Okay. I'm just gonna read to you what you wrote.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we can like talk about, because I think that you do just you do a really nice job establishing the idea, but then we can like
go pick it apart.
Go in.
Okay.
Yeah. So you wrote on with Prism Therapy online on Instagram, you wrote, "We can be so up in our heads and binary in our view of the world, searching for rules, regulations, and answers in a realm where answers cannot be absolute, and moreover, should not be. Sometimes the very essence of life, the very essence of love, in fact, is the beauty of that which is beyond the power of words and sometimes even reason. It is the feeling. It is art. It is imagination. It is creativity. It's that which can't be explained, but only felt. It's our ability to take risks with our hearts, to do something we wouldn't normally do, to share how we feel about someone else, to admit that maybe we don't have it figured out, to have humility, to not be afraid to say we don't know, to open up our cynical armor, to say that actually we do have higher hopes. We as humans are greater than the sum of our parts, and if we limit our experience of the world to just those isolated parts of logic, then we are missing out on a much greater experience of connection, joy, curiosity, and conversations that keep us alive." Well written. Well done, Louise.
I wrote that?
I believe so.
Damn. Good.
Yeah. I can't even tell you how many boxes that's ticking for what's going on in my life right now without being, I can't really be too open and public about certain things that are happening in my life right now, but I'm like, that is, there's like some situations in my life that are breaking rules, but that are working for me on an emotional level that is sort of taking precedence over the rules
and
that
the
are
logic.
Being broken. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And how does that feel?
it's very hard to explain to certain people. I feel like I'm always like prefacing everything, like going, "Now listen, what I'm about to tell you it doesn't make sense on paper,
yeah.
But there's a feeling here, and I don't know. Like I wonder about like do you feel like it's always a good idea to follow that emotional truth or that emotional resonance? Or do you feel like we can be deceived by feelings or
feelings? Just like I always, this is my little mantra. Thoughts are not facts and feelings do not predict the future. Feelings are not truths, but it doesn't make them any less valid. Right.
Yeah, it's great.
Feelings are a compass, you know, they let you know that something's up. They let you know maybe that you've gone off track. And that's how I talk about, you know, when I work with clients and they come with depression or they come with anxiety, and the feelings that they describe in their bodies when we get there. Sometimes it's very actually hard to describe the feeling in the body because it's just a bleh, or it's an ennui, or it's a lack of or a scarcity of, but that's a feeling. That's also a feeling, that numbness. But it doesn't define anything, and it doesn't define a truth. It just is. And this is very much related to that, is that we're always looking for an answer. We're always looking for the solution. We're always looking for a way to describe what it is, because we feel that that will help us understand it, or somehow that will help us arrive at a solution. But we miss the point. Because sometimes the solution is simply just the feeling of what happens. It's just the feeling.
Yeah, sometimes it's like there are certain experiences and certain things where it's like you're not meant to be able to like write this out in an equation.
Yeah.
And like, you know, backwards solve for X. Like where it's like, okay, well, I have X. We've arrived at X. This is what's happening. Now let me go through and write the proof for how that conclude. And it's like, there are things in our world where that's not the case, where you can't actually write that equation out.
Nor should you, right? Because you're actually hijacking your own experience by doing that.
Yeah.
But we live in a world where it's all about that. You know, I mean, every single individual almost feels obliged to express an opinion on things they know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we live in now. And we miss the point entirely. Right, because by looking for language and looking for ways to describe and articulate what we're experiencing, it makes us feel good in theory, right? It makes us feel knowledgeable. It makes us feel like we can stand up and be counted. It actually makes us feel powerful too. But we deny ourselves the opportunity to feel. And, you know, we have a mind and a body, and we separate these two things. Medicine separates these two things. And that is one of the biggest failures of our society, is that we separate these two things. And that combined with this need and this urge to always articulate and define and describe and have a solution is just denying us the experience of feeling. And that feeling is living, right? That's actually what living is. We talk about healing, we talk about recovery. We can't do any of those things if we always have to have an answer and a solution. Because healing and recovery is centered in the ability to hold the tension of the opposites.
Ooh, that's good. Yeah, because I was saying to someone earlier today that I think what I'm discovering right now in my process of therapy is that like one of my biggest problems, if not the biggest, that I'm working through is shame, is like how to deal with shame. And I was saying that I intellectually understand it, and I get it, and I can even see it now, and I think I see it more than I used to, and I can see it when it comes up, and I go like, oh, there it is again. There's that shame. And I can see how I can find a way to shame myself for pretty much anything, how I can make anything that happens my fault somehow, where like, you know, if I have like if something's going wrong with my health or something, I'm like, well, of course it does. You don't take good care of yourself. You know, what do you expect? You treat yourself like shit, and like, you know, but it's like, why can't it just be that, like, that's what bodies do? That, like, that, and I see people all the time who I'm like, I don't know. Look at that. You know, like you watch a video of like a, they'll be interviewing like a 110-year-old lady in a retirement home, and they're like, "How'd you do it?" And she's like, "I don't know. I smoke cigarettes every day and drink a 2 liter."
Sweetie, where's my whiskey?
Yeah, she's like, "I drink a 2 liter of Dr. Pepper every day," and she's like, "That's the key." And you're like, "That's not like what?" And it's just sort of like there's no rhyme or reason to some of this stuff. I know people who have like lived an incredibly healthy lifestyle, work out every day, they're eating, they're monitoring their diet, and they get cancer at 40 years old. And it's like, who, like, but I will find a way to make it my fault and make it about some kind of character failing of my own.
Why?
Why?
Because I don't know. It gives you control.
Oh. Okay. That's so interesting. But this is the thing is, like, I can intellectually understand that. Mm. I can even hear you say that and go like, oh, it's about control. Mm. But then I'm like, it still doesn't stop me from doing it.
Yeah.
It still doesn't stop me from, when something comes up, experiencing it through shame.
Yeah. Because you've done it all your life, probably.
Oh, yeah.
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 This isn't just something you picked up yesterday.
No.
Licked off the ground, as my dad likes to say.
No.
You didn't lick it up off the ground.
And but maybe the answer there is that, like, I can't beat this by intellectualizing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have to find a way to experience the emotions associated with shaming myself and make it, and the disappointment or the, you know, the, whatever it is, and hold, like you said, that space for the emotional opposites, you know, like, and also be proud of myself for recognizing it and hold that space and just be able to be in the discomfort of the shame and stuff, and just, and yeah, like you said, I didn't just pick it up yesterday. And I think that there is hope in knowing, like, it's been recognized. Like, my therapist is aware of it and recognizes it. And now I'm being more aware of it. And that's maybe a part of the process, but I don't know that I can beat it by game planning out an intellectual strategy necessarily. Mm. It seems like the solution has to be emotional, because the problem feels fundamentally emotional.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
If I was to ask you how do you know you feel shame?
Just it manifests in
where?
Yeah, it's like it's not intellectual. It's 100% an emotional experience.
Yeah. It's in your heart.
Yeah.
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 And yet we get locked up here trying to figure it out, and trying to also using, which everybody uses in some shape or form. And sometimes it's healthy to use it in small amounts. But one of the biggest things that we all do to differing degrees is avoidance. And avoidance looks like reasoning, constantly reasoning and rationalizing something, pushing it away, denying it, ignoring it, using substances to actually obliterate it so you don't have to deal with it, telling yourself stories about it to make it feel better. I always talk about this short-term relief but long-term grief thing. Right, so the way we push things away because we don't have to feel that pain in the moment, we get that short-term relief. But we, as long as we keep kicking it out and not looking at it in the eyes, right, in the eyeballs, actually looking at what this feeling is here in your chest and sitting with it and breathing into it and just letting it be there, so much of healing and coming home to yourself. I find this very hard, by the way, in my own life.
Is
letting go. It's the surrender and the release. I hated that word, surrender. Don't talk to me about surrender. I'm going to fight my way to the nail to get things done. Right? I'll fight my way to recovery.
Well, and again, it's like, how do I surrender? Because that's another concept that I'm like, I understand it intellectually. I understand like the merit in like letting something go and being like, hey, I'm just going to set that down. It's not for me, and there's nothing I can really do about it. I'm going to let that go. But it's easier to understand than to actually do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because even as he said that, that's a rationalizing.
Yeah.
But I could see you didn't feel it. Your eyes were like, I'm going to let it down.
Yeah.
But it's, and this is part of, and maybe Niall spoke about this last week as well, but this is part of therapy. This is part, and it should be part of somatic therapy, which is, how do you make friends with your body? How do you start to learn the language of your body? You know, because it speaks in different ways to you, and we consistently ignore it until it stops you dead in your tracks.
Yeah.
And it forces you to look. You know, and I have worked with clients who wake up age 50, 60, profound depression. Right? And they think they're broken. They think there's something fundamentally wrong with them. But there's not, right? This is about looking. Where did you go off track? Where in your life did you stop looking at the things that brought you joy, or stop pursuing the things that you felt you were drawn to, or that imbued you with a reason for living and vitality? When did you start denying that to yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to, life is hard at times, right? There's financial pressures, there's all sorts of other pressures. But if we really fundamentally go off track, away from who we really are, that's depression.
Yeah.
You're not broken.
Uh-huh.
You just got lost.
Yeah, that's great. Last night I was at an art show that my friend started painting this last year, and he had his first show with his pieces. And this person I was at the show with asked me, what's your favorite like period of painting, or like period of art? Or, and I was like, oh, I don't know. And she was like, well, who's your favorite painter? And I was like, yeah, again, I'm like, I was like, you know, I like lots of different things for different reasons. I was like, but I think when I was a kid, I was very obsessed with like Van Gogh and Monet.
Mm.
And I didn't really have the language to explain it then. But again, I didn't really need to be able to explain
it.
The fact that I understood this as like an 8-year-old child without having language to put to it is sort of more of a testament to what we're talking about here, the emotional reality of things. Because what I think I resonated with, or what resonated with me about Monet's work in particular, is the way that like he just sort of leans into a colorscape,
mm-hmm.
and that it's sort of like, it's that impressionism of like, this is a painting that you can tell what it is. It's like a bunch of sailboats at sunset, you know, but it's not realism. It's not painted to the, where he's trying to get every little detail of the sailor and what his hat and the detail in the ropes that he's tying around to the dock. It's the idea of sailboats at sunset, and it's the vibe and the feeling of it. And he manages to capture the feeling of looking at that and the way that it feels to actually be there. And that's such an interesting thing to explore as an artist, to be like, it's not about how close did I get this to what it would actually look like with your eyes. It's more about how do you feel when you're at that place looking at that. And Van Gogh sort of did that too, where it's like, how does it feel to be in a field of flowers? Like, how do you feel when you're engaging with nature? Mm-hmm. And how do you feel when you're looking up at the night sky? What does it feel like to you? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look like the swirly swirls with all the texture and everything, literally, but it feels like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I like, once the 20th century rolls around too, and we start getting Jackson Pollock and Mark and people just kind of doing something where it's like, let's dispatch entirely with forms and let's just go all vibe, like all just like, how do you feel when you look at this piece, and where it's just paint and graphite and things smattered on the canvas. Does it work for you on an emotional level? And there's no real explaining it. And you can sit there and be an art snob and try to explain about, oh, well, you can really see the pain and the duality, and that you can try to intellectualize it. But really, it's like, does this, when you looked at this first thing, does it connect? Does it hit a nerve somewhere emotionally or not?
Mm.
And I love that. It's one of my favorite things about paint and art.
Yeah.
You know?
100%. And what you've just described is the perception of the other. All of that was the perception of the onlooker.
Mm.
But the feeling of the artist is something entirely different.
Oh, totally.
Right. And where was I? It was in Paris. I was in MoMA, the Modern Art in Paris, Museum of Modern Art. And just like that, there were some incredible, bizarre things going on in there. You know, there was a whole corner of one room of the museum that was just dots, painted dots.
Mm-hmm.
At the same, I think it was 33 centimeters between each dot. That was it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was it. There was another film of a man just smashing things on a table. So somebody would keep putting things on the table, he would keep smashing it. And I just loved it all. I laughed, but I loved it all because I just thought, this is not about us, actually. This is about the expression of the person creating this.
Totally.
And that's
totally
the connection with the emotion. And we eavesdrop almost on that.
Yeah, and we put all of our own shit all over it.
Yeah.
And we make it about us because we're great at that. And we make it, you know, yeah. And we can all, I mean, at least I am. I always am great at turning it back around and making it about, like, how is this, how do I relate to this,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. We're definitely just watching, because, and yeah, when people say like, well, this is bad art, like, this isn't good art. And I'm like, well, you don't really get to make, you actually don't get to make that determination, because what you're saying is, this is not connecting for me emotionally.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not having any kind of experience with this. But what they don't realize is they are having an experience. They're sort of, because people get mad.
Yeah,
they'll get upset. Right. They'll look at something and go like, what?
Yeah.
You sold that for $2 million?
Yeah.
You know, and they're upset. And that this thing, this person expressing themselves emotionally and expressing an emotional reality that can't really be intellectualized, having value somehow makes people upset.
Yes.
And I'm like, but you're having an emotional experience with this, even if it's a negative one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you are being affected by this piece in a way that also, like, you're upset that it doesn't make logical sense.
Yes.
You're upset that you can't quantify somehow. Like, no, like, a painting should be worth how closely it looks like a tree.
Yeah.
If it's a painting of a tree, it should be more expensive based on how much like a tree it looks.
Yeah.
And like, that's not how it
works. Yeah.
And like, even if I say it like that, it's like, isn't that silly?
Yeah. But that's the word. But you know, actually, what's great about what you just said is you could nearly apply that to everything now.
Totally.
Every conversation that we have, every opinion, is that the truth? Is that fact? Is that what's really going on here in this political situation or whatever it is? It's this sort of attempt to always have the best version of the reality, and this one wins.
Yes.
But here we are again, back at the same problem. Like, I always actually find, I find it, you know, isn't it so ironic that in one of the greatest sort of most successful aspects of identity politics was the push against being binary in any way, right? And yet, when it comes to important conversations, we're so desperate to categorize people as either all good or all bad, the hero or the villain, the oppressed or the oppressor.
Wow, that's such an keep going. But that's such an interesting take that I actually hadn't considered. But I'm really into this.
But but again, it's certainty.
Mm-hmm.
I need certainty. I can't sit with the tension of this opposite. You can't be this. You can't be both. You need to be one or the other, because I feel more comfortable with that. And there's the key, right? We push back against this and we want to define it as one or the other in an attempt to feel comfortable. We are orienting ourselves as a society around preventing the feeling of discomfort.
I like, literally, maybe that's where a lot of the incongruity is happening between the ideological divide when it comes to our modern exploration of identity. Because I'm just so into this idea that, like, we successfully, I think, are changing the narrative on fitting all of humanity into one of two boxes and being like, there's a man box and a woman box.
Mm-hmm.
And we've known for decades now that, like, there, and really all throughout human history, that there are people who just, like, haven't comfortably sat in one of those two boxes.
Yeah.
And we just, I think throughout the 20th century and certainly throughout this century, we are finding out that, like, it's way more people than we initially thought.
Mm.
In fact, it's probably, like, more normal than not that those two rigid boxes don't actually work.
Mm.
And it's not that everyone is non-binary or a they, them, or trans, but it is that the rigid box of, like, what makes up masculinity traditionally and what makes up femininity traditionally don't serve most the people who occupy 100%. Those boxes.
Yeah.
And if it does, it's like some aspects of that do.
Yeah.
Like I like watching sports. I like watching football and stuff. And that's the part of me that's like the most traditionally masculine thing. But then I'm also like, there's so many aspects of my identity that that don't align with traditional masculinity. And I think it's the fact that we've successfully introduced that or gotten that idea across. But then at the same time, in trying to communicate that idea, if anyone's not getting it right away or is pushing back against it or is having that emotional response like a person to a piece of art that like, no, this doesn't make sense to me. We're very binary with them.
Yeah.
Well, you're a bad guy.
Yeah.
Because you don't get this. You're a bad person because you don't understand this piece of art or this. You don't understand this concept of identity being more multifaceted than one of two things.
Yeah.
So you're bad.
Yeah.
And I think I'm guilty of that. I think I'm guilty of putting that on people and being like, no, your lack of understanding in this area is making you a villain in my eyes, you know, because you're opposing the cause of breaking the harmful gender binary, which I do think has caused a lot of damage throughout our history.
Yeah.
That is such a fascinating concept.
But also it's coupled with the fact that, again, with the advent of social media and this rapid communication in small ways, right, we only have limited ways to communicate ideas, all of that has contributed to the idea of that we now need to be ideologically safe. And, you know, I really, and I see it.
Yeah, find a team and stick there, right? But, is that what you mean by it?
Find a team and stick there, but also opposite thoughts or people who haven't arrived at the same space that I have in what I think makes me unsafe.
Mm.
And that's in you, right? That's in ourselves. Being ideologically safe is removing us from reality of living. Because I think if we continue to try and pave the way with cotton wool before we move forward, we're actually weakening our ability to be in the world. We're lessening our coping mechanisms. Right? So much of what we encounter, even difficulty in others, even opposition in others, even if they're categorically point blank incorrect in their views, right? This is about you. What's going on inside of you here? Right? Because you know, for some reason, my mind has jumped into the humiliation of the ego, right? I actually think we all need to go through that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because our own progression through life is the breakdown of these expectations and these rigid boxes. And if we're trying to burst open rigid boxes, then we need to do it within ourselves as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that involves not categorizing people as good and bad and hero and villain, right? Or the oppressor and the oppressed. And that takes a huge amount of courage and a huge amount of humility. See, huge.
Oh, see, we made it back.
Yeah.
We started talking about why people do the things that they do, terrible things. Yeah. I thought it related.
Yeah.
And good job.
Thanks.
Louise, you brought it. You brought it back around to why that guy that wound up in your car years later, do you know that it's rather than just, oh, well, he's just evil. He's just an evil person.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, you know, like maybe there are aspects of his identity that lean toward villainous tendencies or violence or not even maybe, almost certainly if a person has committed violent crime, but also like, do those impulses, do those things, does that complexity exist in all of us to some extent? And can, if we are having this conversation about how our identities are multifaceted and more complex, I mean, I feel like I could do an entire episode of this podcast too, just about labels and how for some people, I do think labels are incredibly helpful and like helping them identify something about themselves. It's like, oh, that's why I do that because I'm in that group of people, but
you can get stuck there.
Totally. And with any label, there's going to come a ton of intersectionality.
Yeah.
There's going to come like, I have that label. Mm-hmm. I mean, it helped me to understand myself as a person who has a problem with alcohol dependency, to like understand that and go like, oh, okay, and I'm not different than these other alcoholics that I've met. Like, I used to separate myself from them because I was like, I'm not like them. I don't have that. But understanding that about myself and not separating myself from them helped me, and that was useful.
Yeah.
But that's not where my identity begins and ends. Mm. And that's my identity as an alcoholic and part of that group is layered with a bunch of intersections that don't coincide with other people's intersections and stuff, and makes it so that I'm not just firmly in that camp, but, and I like, it's so interesting how we can understand that and see, like, there's so much emotional reality to identity.
Yeah.
So much of identity is like how I feel and what, and what,
and that changes, right?
Yes.
Which
yes.
is a really, really critical point.
Mm-hmm.
That changes.
Yeah.
And this is another difficulty. And I'm gonna speak for and against labels here.
Mm.
Because this is another difficulty with labels. Is if we come out all guns blazing. This is it. This is what I am. This is who I am in multiple ways. And I've done this. We've all done this in different ways across our life to this point. You know, I'm a composer, or I'm a, even at that level, like I'm this, I'm that.
Yes.
And then you find a couple of years later, I'm not that anymore, or I don't actually want to be that anymore. And I used to see this in mental health as well. And people would say, I am bipolar, for example.
Mm.
I think you're not that. You might have symptoms akin to something that has been labeled as that. Let's look at that.
Mm.
And let's look at where that came from. But that too can change. So there's the difficulty with it, because we can become really stuck behind the bars of what that almost scripts us to be.
Right.
And that can bring relief into your life, which is why we get stuck there. Like you just said, it can be really helpful to say, well, I'm this and this and this. Oh, thank God, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Whew. You know, I feel a little bit free now that I know that. But over time, now I'm stuck behind the bars of what this is, and I'm almost unconsciously playing to the expectation of what I'm supposed to be here.
Yeah, and maybe even afraid of, like, who am I without this now?
Yes.
What happens if I outgrow this label or this box, or outgrow the usefulness of this label in my life?
Yeah.
And am I okay with...
Yeah.
I mean,
Man, who am I letting down maybe now?
Right.
Because I've made a community.
Right.
I'm part of this community now.
I mean, I've met people in AA who it was at a time incredibly useful for them, and it helped them get through something that they needed to work through, or get to a next level of life that they needed to get through. And then those same people, I've met people who have just made the determination on their own, I think I'm going to step away from this and I'm going to try something else. I'm going to try to see if I can have a different relationship with drugs and alcohol going forward in my life that maybe is more moderate, and that has, you know, and the story that's often told in recovery communities is that, like, that never works. That never works, period. And I'm like, well, we only ever hear about the ones that don't work because they come back.
True.
And they're like, I went out and did it and it didn't work. But like, we don't hear from the people who, like, step out and it's okay. But I've talked to one of those people, there's like an immense amount of shame on their end because they feel like they're letting me down. They're like, you're going to not like me. You're going to think that I'm weak-willed.
Or I've let you down.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, no, this is your experience and your life.
Yeah.
And if working this program and being a part of this system is working for you and is beneficial to you, then by all means, keep doing what's working. But if this label for you, or this box, or this way of life is no longer serving you... And no longer helping you to grow in the ways that you need to grow, then, like, Godspeed. And I mean,
it happens
with relationships, people who just like, my identity is this relationship.
Yeah.
And then you're definitely letting down that other person if you have to say, I'm so sorry, but this identity no longer works for me.
Which becomes even more complicated when there's enmeshment, right? Or codependency, which is, well, I don't know what I am without you, actually. And if you leave, I fall apart. Or I only have value insofar as you see it in me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you leave, well, I'm going to pretty much collapse on the floor, right? And we see a lot of that as well in relationships. It's that intense enmeshment issue. But I just want to say the other thing, the flip side about labels.
Yes.
I don't want to be so down on them either.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
But the flip side, and this is again much more of a a thing I'm seeing, I guess you could call it a more of a modern thing, which is an unattachment, right? It's an unattachment to things and relationships even, and the casual nature of them works so well in many ways. And it's freedom, right? Isn't it? It's freedom mm-hmm. for us, you know, and to have relationships in whatever guise that we choose. And it's been wonderful in so many ways. Mm. And it's allowed us to explore and be adventurous, right? And do things that never would have been, well, certainly not in Catholic Ireland, right? permitted
yeah.
over the years. But we're now able to explore each other and really be enriched by what we're discovering. Where I'm seeing it again becoming a problem is, you know, the on again, off again, the relationships that go on and on and on without any label, right? Mm. Without any definition of what this is.
Well, situationships.
The situationships. Yeah, the yeah. situationships. That can actually be really damaging after a time on sure. your sense of self.
Yeah.
And so here's where it becomes important, actually, when you feel it within yourself, to figure out what is this? Because having definitions at that point and labels actually has the effect of setting you free. Because you don't have to take up a portion or percentage or 20% of your headspace thinking about this every day, is it or isn't it? Are we or are we not?
Yeah. And on that same line, too, just when it comes to relationships and just like the emotional reality that goes into that, because so much of it is feeling like
yeah.
it's one of those things, like you said in that post, and that just like art and love are two things that we really can understand as like, I don't know how to intellectualize yeah. this and I don't know if I want to at all
yeah.
because I don't want to pick a partner because it makes sense on paper. It'd be great if I could have both. If I could like really, really care about this person yeah. deeply emotionally and all the ducks were in a row when it comes to, oh, they've got their finances together and they've got their own, you know, it'd be great. But it doesn't always work out that way.
Yeah.
And I also think that like, I mean, as a person who's lived my life, who's been in love with multiple different people mm-hmm. and in like, you know, deep loving relationships with multiple people and had different chapters of being single and dating and all that stuff. Even though I find that the ability to have different experiences with different people is plentiful. Mm-hmm. Like obviously my life has been chapters of different people mm-hmm. and there's the world is full of people that hope plenty of fish in the sea thing. I also think all of my experience dating and being out in that world has shown me that like, it is kind of rare to experience that emotional charge with another person. And there's something to pay attention to, I think, there in that emotional reality aspect of it, of like when you're trying to figure out what it is, like you were saying, what is this? You're agonizing. It's like, is that thing there? Are you both feeling that thing? And if both people are lining up going, I can't get away from this, whatever it is, whatever it is that's drawing to me, you to me, that's a really hard thing to, even if on paper yeah. it's like nothing about this should work.
Yeah.
Sometimes that emotional aspect
yeah.
wins out.
Yeah.
And you got misgivings about that.
No, misgivings. No, not so much misgivings. I have an understanding of that on my personal level. I have an understanding of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have obviously my other hat on understanding of that too,
yeah.
which is, so much of how we feel in love, in situations of love, is about us.
Mm.
And it's about what we see in the other that completes what we feel is missing within ourselves quite often. But it is also about our attachment. It's also about what we have learned and what we've defined as love. And if we have learned something about ourselves, let's take shame for an example, right? If we have learned actually when something goes wrong or something goes off track, my entire existence is to blame. My inadequacy is to blame, as opposed to this is just an unfortunate incident. No, this is because of my entirety.
Mm.
That's something that also gets played out in adult relationships. Because somebody might make us feel the opposite, right? So
yeah.
no, my entire self is to blame and inadequate here. But this person is making me feel like I am. I mean, I'm the opposite of shameful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm heroic.
Mm.
I am something to be exonerably proud about. And that feels like coming home.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah.
But in the same way, that feeling is invested in another. And you're looking at yourself through their eyes. And that's what makes it precarious. And it's not to say, though, and here again, tension of the opposites, right? It's not to say, we want that. We want the charge. You know, if we're not sexually charged in relationship to our partners, then it's a friendship.
Yeah. But it's more than sex, because I've dated people who there's definitely a sexual charge, and we enjoy that aspect of being like, well, this separates us from just being buds who hang out.
Yeah.
We have this going on too.
Yeah.
But it's that thing that you were just saying about like, but is there that extra thing that's even more ineffable, where it's like, yeah, you turn me on, but I feel like I can trust you to see me the way I want to be seen.
Yeah.
For some reason, I feel like when you look at me, you see me the way that I would like to. And, I feel like I'm seeing you the same way.
Yeah.
And there's something about the inner self and the unknowability, the fundamental unknowability of the inner self, that like everyone can see my outer shell even better than I can in some ways, because I only ever see it in a reflected mirror where it's flipped, you know, but other people can really, and they get to a better look at my facial expressions as I talk and stuff that I don't usually get to see. But there's that unknowability of the inner self, and that's sort of what we're after, is like, can I find someone who seems to see seems to see in there, and at the end of the day, like, it's, there's certain aspects I think that can never be known fully about the inner self, but also they are known in this sort of universality of that experience, that everyone has this inner life that we're desperately trying to. I watched this video essay recently that was quite beautiful, that was describing the act of making love as like trying to get literally into the inner person, being like, I'm trying to like get you in here, and again, like, it almost feels weird to try to have a conversation intellectualizing it when it's like, I can't, can't be said, can't be said,
which is such a beautiful bloody thing,
right?
And that's what I mean. It doesn't have to be right. Actually, let me put it that way. It doesn't have to be right. Even if it is so powerful and charged and wrong on paper in many ways. Okay, you know, what are we searching for? Are we searching for fairy tales? Which, you know, I actually put up another post about fairy tales, which are just laden with pain.
Yeah.
You know, life is laden with pain, but along those experiences of pain, my God, do we learn a lot. That in, and you know, sometimes I quite often, different periods of time, I think about life and I think about why, and that interminable question, what's the meaning?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just to deviate. You know what it's like when you've met somebody who has been untouched by the suffering of life. You know what that's like.
Yeah.
It's quite a boring experience. And so
get some trauma. Like, get some stories for me here.
Because I always think that the more you've been through, the deeper the groove into your soul and into your heart is created.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, that hurts, right, because it's cutting in there.
Mm-hmm.
But that is the bigger space that you can fill with joy, and more space that you can feel with the experience of the gifts that life has, like love.
Mm.
And I think the I hate using the word goal, but I feel like the impetus in life, or the motivation, or what imbues us with vitality is getting into the hit the depths of that heart feeling, because no words are needed. It's just the pure joy in that moment, and it could be fleeting and it'll move on because life is transient,
right?
Yeah
that's a big thing.
Yeah,
is like, just because it ends doesn't mean it wasn't real, or doesn't mean it wasn't important,
100%, and doesn't mean it hasn't changed you.
Yeah,
and being changed, and being, allowing yourself to be changed by what you experience, good or bad, and coming out of it. Like the humiliation of the ego, the destruction of the self, rebuilding it up again. That is actually what I feel the meaning of life is.
I actually think that a lot of people live their life without experiencing that broken down ego and the building of it back up enough.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's going to get some of that. I think that it's kind of unavoidable, but like, I think people create safeguards to prevent them from having to go through that too many times it's painful.
But this is exactly my point about society and creating a space where we are refusing to be uncomfortable because it doesn't feel nice.
Right.
We're creating disorder by doing that. Mm-hmm. Disorder is the avoidance of discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
So if we insist on having everything perfect and right and orderly, then we remove ourselves from the reality of life. We can't control other people. We can't control what they do. You know, I also work with abuse cases, addiction cases, some of the most horrible cases that you could even imagine in Ireland. I work with children and families who are laced with these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I come out of that situation and I listen to society talking about this idealistic world of stopping people being violent, you know, and protecting everything so beautifully and wrapping it up in bows, and that's beautiful and it would be wonderful to live in that utopia.
Yeah.
But it's just simply never going to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? For a number of reasons. Because of disadvantage, because of disenfranchisement, because people grow up in absolute, they've got nothing in their lives, nothing. They grow up with no money, no love. They do not know what it is to be part of a family, to be connected. They've grown up being mistreated all of their lives. This is what creates it. And memes, you know, and quick mottos about ending this, and then it's not going to work. And that's not to be down on it. Yes, we should hope for better and we should work for more. And that's what I do. It's why I'm in the job that I'm in, is because I want to impact people's lives. But there's also a reality about take away the cotton wool from that path. Go out into it. This will exist, but you will do well if you're prepared to cope with that uncomfortable feeling in your heart when you do it. It will be worth it, right? Because you're still doing what you believe in, what you're passionate about. And that's what people connect with. People can't connect when you put the walls up and you refuse to enter into the discomfort space.
Yeah.
They can't connect with that.
Well, and some people are trying to avoid the connection. You know, like it's like, well, yeah. I did that on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I know they can't connect, and that is by design. I don't want them to. I want to get your thoughts on something I read yesterday that kind of fucked me up. But I'm like reading this book by Pema Chodron. She's this, you know, she's a Zen Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
She read, fantastic book. This is from When Things Fall Apart. And this was yesterday. And I was like, oh, shit. I'm just going to read one line from it. Well, she says, "We forget what we've learned through meditation and know to be true. When really strong emotion comes up, all the doctrines and beliefs that we've held on to seem kind of pitiful by comparison because emotions are so much more powerful." And she's sort of speaking here about like the need to temper your reaction to your emotions, because she's like, yeah, your emotional state is very powerful. And so all these principles and doctrines and beliefs that have gotten you through, or that you've been relying on, are really easy to throw out the window when you get hit with a really strong emotion. Yeah. So again, if you have relationships, if you have rules about what you will and won't do in relationships, or who makes a good partner for you, and I'm not going to date a person unless they make this amount of money or whatever. But then you meet someone and you have that emotional experience, and you're like, well, I'm throwing the rule book out the window because, you know, and it's like, is that a reasonable or smart or safe thing to do? Like, do you have any problem with what Pema Chodron says there? Or do you, like, as a psychologist, go, yeah, I get that? Or
no, I get that. I don't have a problem with what she said, but I will respond to your interpretation of it.
Okay. So,
Yeah. Okay. So how I would differentiate what you said is, you said, you know, we need to temper the strength of the emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I would disagree with that.
Okay.
We need to temper our reaction and our action. So if we act based on the intense emotional experience, we could go off a cliff.
Okay.
But if we allow the intensity of the emotional experience to be there without acting, without taking action, without behaving, without doing anything in response to it, just experiencing it and really experience. I mean, and I've done this a few times, right? And realize I've been avoiding, but not being right, not feeling good, pushing away. I'm fine. Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And then realizing, actually, I'm not fine. And the thing that I'm thinking is so unreasonable that I've been afraid to admit to myself what I've been thinking.
Yeah.
But when I do, and the sobs come up, and I mean like proper, full on, ugly crying, right, sobbing with this unreasonable thought that I can even see in the midst of this wild crying that this is probably not true. But this is, doesn't matter. Right? It doesn't matter because my entire body thinks that it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I learned probably pre-language to some extent. This was a feeling that got stuck inside of me because of whatever. And here it is again. And the mere act of letting it be there, of acknowledging that it's there, not trying to reason with it, not trying to push it down or say it's wrong, that intense emotional experience and just fully letting my body be consumed by it got me through it and moved me out the other side so that I could take action now in line with what I give a shit about.
Mm-hmm.
Not in response to this intense fear.
Yeah.
Or unreasonable emotion that I had.
Mm-hmm.
It is just, and this comes back to the earlier thing again, it's just the experience of the intensity that you need to do. It doesn't get more complicated than that. That's it.
Yeah.
And I think people find that really difficult to integrate because no, surely it's got to be something bigger than this. Mm-hmm. Surely there's some kind of program I need to do to navigate my way through. No, just let it fully manifest in your body. Mm. Feel every piece of it. And it's scary to do that, actually. It's scary to kick open those gates because you don't know if you're going to stop crying. And I have worked with people who didn't stop crying for weeks when they did. And that's inconvenient, to say the least. Right? But I tell you something, they move through it.
Well, that's fantastic. And yeah, that was great. That's kind of how I wanted to close things out. And it was great. Your response to it was excellent. Louise, thank you so much for coming and offering me just a free therapy session at my little Blanket Fort recording studio. Really, really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Where can people follow you to keep up on great tips from your beautiful mind?
Oh, thank you. Louise Carroll, Louise with a Z, Louise Carroll on Instagram. I'm also co-founder of an online therapy platform called Prism Therapy Online. So that's also on Instagram. It's Prism_Therapy_Online. And that's where most of the content goes up. I share it sometimes on my own as well. But yeah, I can be found there. Or on the Blizzards.
Yeah, they can go listen to the Blizzards.
Or I can play the bass now.
And, yep, a seasoned bass player now.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, go listen to the Blizzards and go check out Prism Therapy Online on Instagram or follow Louise Carroll on Instagram. This was just a pleasure and you did not disappoint in the slightest. And this was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yep. Okay, bye everybody.
Bye.
Yeah, so there that is. There it is. I just think it's a fascinating topic that we don't think... I mean, when I read that Instagram post by Louise, it kind of struck me and I was like, oh, you know what? There's so much truth there that so much of our lived experience is processed through the lens of what is emotionally true and emotionally real and is processed through the lens of emotion. And we're always trying to give it language or to quantify it somehow or to intellectualize it somehow. And a lot of this stuff can't be intellectualized and shouldn't be. And I don't know. I think that's just an interesting thing to think about. And that's why I started this show, is to think about things like that, things that I don't necessarily have concrete answers for or theories on, but things that just make me go, that's fun to think about. I hope you got something out of it too, as well. Yeah, now that's what I call a bunch of Austin Archer's TikTok songs compiled into an album. Volume 4 is available now. Friday, February 3rd, it's available now. You can find it at the link in my bio on all of my social media platforms, or you can go to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com, and it'll be right there. And if you pick it up today, Friday, February 3rd, 100% of whatever you buy on my Bandcamp will go to me. It'll go to the artist. Bandcamp waives their service fee. It's Bandcamp Friday. But any other day, if you're listening to this on any other day and you're like, oh no, I missed it, you should still go pick it up if you want it, because Bandcamp's profit share with artists is always fantastic. They're always sharing like 90% of sales with artists. So today I will get 100% of what you buy, and any other day I'll be getting most of what you buy. So it's still a great way to support if you're listening to this on some other day. I would still encourage you to go check that out. And if you haven't, check out all 4 of those albums. They're all actually really, really fun and full of, I think, really, really great songs. So now that's what I call a bunch of Austin Archer's TikTok songs compiled into an album. Volumes 1 through 4, all available now on my Bandcamp page. Yeah, People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You know where you can find more of my music, right? AustinArcherMusic.bandcamp.com. You can find it at Austin-Archer.com, my official website. You can find it by searching Austin Archer on Spotify and Apple Music. The TikTok songs may be Bandcamp exclusives, but all my other music is still available to stream for free on Spotify and Apple Music. You can check that out. Patreon.com/Austin Archer. If you have the means and you would like to join us over there, we would love to have you as a monthly subscriber to help keep this show moving forward. Thanks again to Louise Carroll. Thank you again to Niall Breslin. Thanks for being my friends and for coming across the pond and hanging out with me. And you can follow Louise on Instagram and check out Prism Therapy as well. That's it. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Love you so much. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye. Qualifies as a song.